Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's Independence Day, almost. You know what that means. Hot dogs, flags, firecrackers, and come on down for hot, hot deals on a new car from Japan. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday, the third day of July. June was a great month to buy a car. The big three U.S. manufacturers spent more than $2.5 billion trying to lure you in with rebates and zero-interest financing. That's according to Edmunds.com. But you didn't bite. Sales fell at both Ford and Chrysler, and GM posted a 24% drop. But Nissan sales revved up 24%. Toyota and Honda spiked, too. And they may be thanking what's an unusual source for them— rebates, and zero-interest financing. Elisa Roth tells us more.
U.S. carmakers are spending less on incentives than they have in previous years. They still have to offer them, though.
If the vehicle is not selling itself in the marketplace, you have to give consumers another reason why they should consider them.
Jesse Toprek directs industry analysis for Edmunds.com. He says the big three still count on incentives like 0% financing or cash rebates to sell cars. Toprek says incentives do work.
Fundamentally, there's nothing wrong with it as long as it's done in incremental basis, it's done in a control basis for a limited period of time.
But U.S. automakers have been using major incentives for years, and consumers have gotten used to them. Now many won't buy a car unless they're offered a sweet deal. Incentives do help clear out inventory quickly, but too many, and they can put a big dent in the manufacturer's bottom line. That's been a major problem for the big three. Japanese carmakers, on the other hand, use the enticements more judiciously, when a particular model's not selling well, for example. It's an approach the big three are starting to imitate. Alan Baum is a consultant for The Planning Edge.
Well, the design, of course, is to be much more targeted, and the timing is such that they're trying to do that by making them have a fairly short shelf life.
Still, says analyst Toprek, Japanese carmakers are spending more on incentives than they used to, and he says it looks like Detroit's revving up for yet another discount race this summer. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
How'd you like to make a cool seven figures? Well, here's how. Rat on your boss and coworkers if they're using pirated software. The Business Software Alliance is offering the Whistleblower a reward. It's a trade group that represents most of the big software companies, including Microsoft, Adobe, and Symantec. The reward program isn't new, but the amount of money you can make for telling on your company has jumped. From WGBH, Helen Palmer has more.
$1 million. That's how much the Business Software Alliance is willing to pay in rewards for qualifying software piracy leads. If you work for a company that's copying software illegally, your company is breaking the law. Blow the whistle and report.
That radio ad is on the airwaves now. It's justified, says the Business Software Alliance's Jenny Blank, because illegal copying of software costs the industry mega bucks.
In the U.S. alone last year, there was over $7 billion in damages to the industry.
But Harvard Business School's Josh Lerner calls those damage calculations disingenuous.
The problem with a lot of those calculations, of course, is it assumes that everyone who is now using a pirated form of this would actually have gone out in the other world and have bought it.
Lerner says that's plainly nonsense. For small startups and in the developing world, those costs are prohibitive. Lerner says $1 million could certainly flush out a few disgruntled workers to dish dirt on their bosses. But he warns it could be a very dangerous career move, given how companies value loyalty. Software expert Ben Clemens of the Brookings Institution says this rewards program from the BSA has a chilling effect on companies. For a start, it's hard to prove that every single piece of software is legal and licensed.
And so this creates an air of guilty until proven innocent. And basically, in economist terms, it raises the cost of proprietary software. Not necessarily in dollar terms, but in terms of what the IT department needs to do to make sure that it doesn't get audited.
But Clemens thinks there'll be one result the BSA may not have anticipated. Companies may turn to open source software, programs like OpenOffice, which are absolutely free, with absolutely no legal threats. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Here's one organization that decided against ratting out one of its members. An upcoming World Bank report found that pollution in China causes about 750,000 deaths every year. But don't look for that figure in the final report. The Chinese government has pressured the World Bank to leave it out. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
With just over a year to go before Beijing hosts the Summer Olympics, China is becoming increasingly sensitive of its environmental track record. The Chinese media reported air quality in the capital last month was the worst in 7 years. And according to figures omitted from an upcoming World Bank report, the issue is a deadly one. Ted Fishman, author of China Inc., says Beijing faces a delicate balancing act on environmental issues.
The Chinese government wants to show that it is deeply concerned, but it doesn't want to show that it's completely out of control of the situation.
Fishman says pollution has become the number one flashpoint for civil unrest in China. And according to a story in the Financial Times, Chinese officials didn't want to add fuel to the fire by including geographically specific death figures in the report. The World Bank says the findings were left out because the Chinese government took issue with the bank's number crunching. And because it was a joint research project with China, the World Bank says it had no choice in the matter. Daniel Rosen of the Institute for International Economics says that's unfortunate, especially as other developing nations try to emulate China.
This is a seminal moment for thinking about how we grow our economies, what our priorities are. Why not have the best information possible about what the health effects are?
Rosen says he's analyzed the same numbers the World Bank left out of its report and found them to be statistically credible. He says that's what makes them so dangerous. By showing the human cost of China's unfettered growth, Rosen says the debate shifts to who's responsible. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
And investors got an early jump on the holiday celebrating. Details when we do the numbers. You know all those box office records set by the big blockbuster movies over the last couple of months? Well, apparently they haven't done enough to balance out the losers. Attendance is actually down from this time last summer. But for folks involved in making the bona fide hits, there could be a sizable payday down the line if they signed up for profit participation deals. The key here is the phrase, down the line. Sometimes it takes years for the money to trickle in. But a new company is offering cash up front for the rights to those future earnings. It's called Content Partners, and CEO Steve Cram is with us to explain. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Explain for us exactly how this works. We're not talking about residuals. We're talking about profit participation, where, say, an actor in a movie has some sort of percentage of the take and a percentage of the coming DVDs and anything that would go online, that sort of thing. So what's your role here?
Our role is to analyze profit participations in movies, television, and music content and project out their future value. So an actor who did a movie might own 20% of the back end, and he could wait a lifetime to collect that money. We do a projection of that income source and provide him with the income today.
Where do you go in on this deal? Is it before the release of a movie or a CD, or is it afterwards when you perhaps can have some sort of idea how it might play with the audience?
Everything we buy is in distribution. So for films, it would already be released. For television shows, it's already airing on television. We don't buy anything that has not been released, and we do not fund production.
So, for example, today, you would wait to see how Transformers actually does in the theaters before going ahead and making a deal with somebody involved in that project.
That's correct. It's very hard for us to do any projection without there having been an initial box office release.
So who are your main clients at this point?
Our clients are everyone from producers, writers, directors, actors, showrunners, musicians, slate financiers that have decided that maybe they'd like some liquidity at this point in the slate deal. Almost anyone that holds a passive profit participation.
Who have you done deals with recently?
We don't talk about the actual clients we've done deals with, but we've, you know, we looked at
deals. You can't tell me a famous actor who's gone ahead and done this with you?
Can't do that because we work under a pretty strict confidentiality. But we've looked at deals involving a producer who wants liquidity in order to invest in another franchise tentpole film project that he believes in. A production company that wants to invest in production facilities in Asia that owns profit participations and wants liquidity. We're providing liquidity to the showrunner of a hit TV series that really is unable to live with the uncertainty of the future cash flows.
I wonder if maybe in the future you might find that the folks who really want to take advantage of something like this are folks whose careers are perhaps on the other side of success.
No, that hasn't really been it. People who are very, very successful and continue to be successful understand the value of being able to get liquidity because otherwise they have their entire net worth tied up in this illiquid, very volatile asset that could be worth a whole lot less when they decide to retire.
Do you know why it's so hard for them to collect this kind of money?
Well, it's not a difficulty in collecting it.
Oh, it's not?
No,
it just takes a long time for it to happen.
It just takes a long time for it to happen, and it plays out over years as this material makes its way down the chain. You know, first from theatrical distribution to pay cable, throughout the cycle, television, cable, you know, and foreign television, it takes years and years. You know, you see movies that were produced 50 years ago on TV today.
True.
Still generating income.
All right. Steve Cram is the CEO of Content Partners. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Every 5 years, Congress passes the hat to drug companies in the form of what's called the prescription drug user fee. It's not actually a fee on users of prescription drugs. It's a fee on Big Pharma. The money goes to the Food and Drug Administration and is used to help run the drug approval process. The fee is scheduled to expire on September 30th. The Senate already reauthorized it. The House will vote on the bill after its July 4th recess. If it passes, drug companies will have to pay a lot more into the pot, as much as $225 million over 5 years. But not everyone thinks the extra money will make drugs safer. From Washington, Snigdha Prakash has the second of two reports.
Blame it on Vioxx, the blockbuster painkiller whose cardiac side effects led to its withdrawal in 2004 after 20 million Americans had used it. Despite the drug industry's strenuous lobbying, most lawmakers have come to believe that American drugs aren't as safe as they should be. California Democrat Henry Waxman has taken the lead in the House on figuring out why.
There's a real push to get drugs approved as quickly as possible. Because of that rush to get drugs approved, we sometimes don't know until larger numbers of people are using the drug that there's a safety problem.
Waxman says drugs need to be scrutinized more closely after they're on the market. But he says the FDA isn't set up for that.
FDA lacks the resources to do reviews that need to be done to catch safety problems. They need personnel to monitor these drugs. They need to make sure that the companies are doing the post-approval studies for safety.
The House Energy and Commerce Committee voted late last month to give the FDA those resources by imposing higher user fees on drug companies. It also voted to give the FDA new authority to demand that companies tell patients about safety risks they find. But some inside the FDA don't think drugs will be any safer as a result. David Graham is deputy director of the FDA's Office of Surveillance and Epidemiology and an outspoken critic of the FDA's safety record. Because the FDA won't let Graham meet with reporters at his office, we went to a deli near his house outside Washington, and Graham explained why he's skeptical.
The drug safety problems that we've had in the recent past, and even in the more distant past, have not been failures of surveillance or failures of identifying the safety problem. They've been failures of decision-making. throwing money at FDA won't change the way decisions are made.
Graham says the problem is the same FDA team that approves a drug for sale also decides what to do if safety problems emerge later. He says approval teams don't like to issue strong safety warnings or to pull drugs. Such actions raise questions about their initial judgments, and they also make drug companies angry. Iowa Republican Chuck Grassley agrees with Graham. As chairman of the Senate Finance Committee for many years, Grassley investigated the FDA's handling of drug safety issues. He describes how the FDA treated scientists with safety concerns in a recent case.
There was a great deal of intimidation not to detract from the party line. And the party line is, don't raise questions.
In May, Grassley tried and failed by just one vote in the Senate to change that culture some. He offered an amendment to the Senate's user fee reauthorization bill to give the FDA's Office of Surveillance and Epidemiology, which tracks drugs after they go on the market, power to act if it sees problems. Right now, that office can only advise the folks who approve the drug. The drug industry opposed the change. It says the right way to make such decisions is by scientific consensus. The FDA also opposed it. An FDA spokeswoman turned down our request for an interview, but at a recent congressional hearing, FDA Commissioner Andrew von Eschenbach made his feelings clear. He was flanked by the head of the Drug Approval Office and the head of the Surveillance Office as he spoke.
We're here as partners, dedicated to collaborating even more closely to do the right thing.
California Democrat Henry Waxman says Americans are counting on the FDA to do just that by acting promptly on safety problems once it has new powers and money. In Washington, I'm Snigdha Prakash for Marketplace.
Coming up, remembering opera diva Beverly Sills.
Art is an indelible record of who we are, what we believe, and what we hold dear.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets started sparkling a little early today. The Dow picked up 41 points, 0.3% to end at 13,577. The Nasdaq added 12 points, nearly 0.5% to finish at 2644. The S&P 500 put on 5 points, 0.3% to close at 1524. Wendy's International chomped up 2.75% after billionaire investor Nelson Peltz said he might want to bid for the company. Investors put the brakes on Ford Motor to the tune of 2.25%. The company reported an 8% decline in U.S. sales last month. Movie Gallery plunged 65% today. The video rental chain said it would break deals with lenders due to significantly softer than expected second quarter results. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note climbed to 5.04%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. AngiesList.com.
Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday, the 4th of July. Markets are closed for the holiday. In Washington, a full day of events will include parades, concerts, and fireworks to celebrate Independence Day. And Esther Pauline Friedman was born on the 4th of July in 1918. The advised columnist, beloved by many, was better known to most as Ann Landers. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Could the Made in China label soon appear on a car lot near you? Technically, no, but a car made in China just might. Tomorrow, Chrysler is expected to finalize a deal with the Chinese automaker Chery. That would presumably lead to the first Chinese-made vehicles being exported to the U.S. under the Chrysler brand. But you may not have to wait for that to happen. Another Chinese manufacturer has teamed up with an American company to assemble Chinese vehicles in Mexico and then import them here. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has that story.
You can't start it up, can you?
No, I can't start it up there. I'm sorry.
Steve Saleen leads a small group of people through a maze of crates inside an industrial warehouse in Las Vegas. He stops at a circled-out section of floor where a truck and an SUV are parked.
Just imagine if you were in a parking lot at Walmart. You could almost put any nameplate on it, and you would accept it as if it was from one of the top eight manufacturers around the world. It doesn't look like it's made in China.
The Grand Tiger truck and the landmark SUV are made by China's Zongxing Automobile, or ZX Auto. Celine, a former race car driver, is CEO of the company's American subsidiary.
There's an unbelievable amount of car here for the price. It really is amazing that you can purchase something like this, this complete, this refined, and drives as well as it does for $13,000. I'm used to a set of wheels costing that much.
One thing keeping the sticker price down is the vehicles will be assembled in Tijuana, then shipped into the U.S. Under NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the vehicles can then enter the U.S. duty-free. Critics of this strategy say the Mexican plant is a Trojan horse. It essentially will allow Chinese vehicles to sneak across the border. CNN's Lou Dobbs recently railed against the plan during his evening broadcast.
An attempt by Communist China to circumvent U.S. trade laws that will almost certainly cost American jobs and give up a portion of this nation's car market. A Chinese automaker exploiting a loophole in NAFTA. It's a move that will, of course, benefit Mexico and China, not the United States.
New Jersey-based China America Cooperative Automotive Inc., or CHAMCO, is bringing the vehicles into the country. Bill Pollack is CHAMCO's CEO. He says his company is simply playing by the rules established by NAFTA.
There's no exceptions here. There's no loopholes here. There's no wiggle room. Whatever the rules are, we will follow them.
It is a loophole to bring subsidized components into Mexico, transform them in Mexico, and then bring them into the United States and not face any consequences.
That's Professor Peter Morrissey with the University of Maryland. He says Chinese car makers already benefit from government subsidies and an undervalued yuan. Now they're exploiting NAFTA's fine print. Manuel Rocha is with the Globus Group, a consulting firm. He says free trade can be a double-edged sword. NAFTA extended the life of U.S. car makers by giving them access to cheap Mexican labor. Soon the Chinese will take advantage of those same rules and beat Detroit at its own game.
Whether it's steel making, whether it's textiles, if there are others in the world's economy that can do it cheaper, then really it doesn't make sense for us to continue to be involved, especially by protecting those industries which are no longer competitive with high tariffs or subsidies.
Back in the dusty warehouse in Las Vegas, dealers pour in from around the country to check out the Chinese models. The vehicles can't be test-driven in the U.S. That's because it'll be another year before they meet U.S. safety standards. The models in the warehouse were made for Chinese roads. They even have the mandatory fire extinguisher in the front seat. Still, some of the dealers present seem impressed.
This is a sharp truck.
It's a very sharp truck. They look, they feel, they drive like everything else. The difference is we cost 20% less.
Experts say Chinese vehicles will transform the U.S. car market in the coming decade. Again, Peter Morrissey.
The advent of the Chinese could be enough to tip the scales and drive an American automaker out of business and cause a major upheaval in the industrial Midwest like we have not seen in many decades.
Morrissey says that could be the real price of a $13,000 SUV. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The diva next door, as Beverly Sills was known, passed away yesterday. In a statement, the music director of the Met, James Levine, said her mission was always to bring the joy and love of opera to as many people as possible. She was also an indefatigable fundraiser throughout the arts community and beyond, making the case to corporate America that the arts were and are a worthy investment of time and money. In 2002, Ms. Sills made that case here on Marketplace. Today, in remembrance, we wanted to hear it again.
I once sat next to an important CEO at a fundraising dinner when I was running the New York City Opera. Over the main course, I asked him for some money to mount some exciting new productions. A lot of money. I asked him for $1 million. The gentleman wasn't known to be a patron of the arts, but he did have a great sense of humor. And he said to me, "If I support the opera, do I have to come?" And I said, "Of course you have to come." "Okay," he said, "I'll give you a deal. I'll give you $1 million if I don't have to come, but I'll give you $900,000 if I'm expected to attend." I told him I'd take the $900,000 and we'd see him at the next performance. And of course, he came with his wife to a beautiful production, sung and acted by beautiful young American singers. The production was La Bohème. Soon after we were seated together at another dinner, this time my gentleman friend was the host, everyone had a little trinket on their plate, except me. So when I asked him, "How come I didn't have anything?" he said, "Look under your damn plate." And there was a check for the remaining $100,000. Another opera lover had been born. Let me make something perfectly clear, corporate America. I'm not just asking for your money. I want your body, too. That's because if you come to our performances, our museums, and our festivals, I know your families, your business associates, and employees will, too. You'll get hooked on our products and services, just as we and our audiences will get hooked on yours. Think of it this way. If someone took a snapshot of our world today, would we want to be remembered for our capacity for self-destruction or for our outpouring of art, music, theater, and dance? Art is an indelible record of who we are, what we believe, and what we hold dear. Ancient Egyptian art is a perfect example of how civilizations have communicated down through the ages. So, corporate America, think of your support for the arts as a way to both give and reap rewards. It's your performance of a lifetime.
Beverly Sills speaking on Marketplace, June 24th, 2002. Ms. Sills died yesterday of lung cancer. She was 78. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication. And this final note, Nielsen ratings have been measuring how much time you spend in front of the tube for decades. Now they'll be tracking how much time you're spending with Grand Theft Auto. Nielsen struck a deal with Sony PlayStation to monitor when you decide to play, what you decide to play, and how long you play it, all in the name of finding out what kind of thief you really are, oh, and what kind of ads you might watch. In the past, games have hosted ads for the likes of Starwood Hotels, Nike, and Pizza Hut. Of course, you could just go online and play World of Warcraft. For now, Nielsen says online game ratings are next. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 41 points, 0.33%. The NASDAQ bumped up 12 points, almost 0.5%. The S&P was up 5 points, 0.33%. Thanks to Miguel Macias, Doug Krisner, and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on the show, hitting the jackpot and going back home to help out.
Everybody has a responsibility or some sort of obligation to the people a little less fortunate.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow and enjoy the holiday.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.